Okay, let us continue with lecture 16. A big change today, because today we'll reap the fruit of all our theoretical effort and in setting up the framework. And today we'll start solving Einstein's equations to describe the universe, which is really, if you think about it, the night sky. Try to think about that. It's really significant. I mean, what we are going to do is solve for the evolution of the night sky. You're no longer calculating how a ball rolls down an incline or how two harmonic oscillators affect each other. If you were seeing the night sky and you had much more patience, like a billion years or so, what would you see? You would see the galaxy rotating and the universe expanding. Well, now we only see one neighboring galaxy, but earlier, billions of years ago, you would have seen more galaxies. So you see the evolution of the sky, and that's what we are going to calculate. We're going to calculate the Friedmann-Lemaître cosmological solutions, also called Friedmann, Robertson, and Walker cosmological solutions, but I was told that Robertson and Walker came a little later than Friedmann and Lemaître. Okay, it's all based on the following experimental evidence. The evidence is that the universe has been expanding and is still expanding. This observation goes back to Hubble and Humason and others from 1929. Also, it appears that the universe is spatially essentially isotropic and homogeneous. Isotropic means looks the same in all directions, and homogeneous means is the same no matter how far you go. And you might say, well, that doesn't seem to be a good approximation, because where we are, there's a planet. But if you just travel a few hundred thousand kilometers, there's no planet. It seems to be totally empty. And so there are large concentrations of matter, and then there is vacuum in between, or almost vacuum, and so on. So how can we say that it's spatially essentially isotropic? Well, even the galaxy isn't the smooth distribution of matter. Even if you take a few galaxies together, that's not yet smooth. But it turns out that if you smoothen out over something like 3 to 4 billion years, billion light years, so if you go to that length scale, then everything seems to be really smooth. There don't seem to be any huge voids or overconcentrations of matter there. So on sufficiently large scales, the universe is pretty much flat. And you might think, okay, but the universe is only 13.8 billion years old, so is it only 13.8 billion light years in size, at least the part that we are connected with, and therefore that's a significant fraction of it? It's not quite true, because the universe has been expanding in all directions. And the stuff that we see now, that we see as it was 13 billion years ago, that has been moving away from us. So really, the part of the universe that's causally connected to us is actually way bigger than 13.8 billion light years. It's more like 30, 40 billion light years at least. The fact that the universe is pretty much homogeneous and isotropic on length scales bigger than this, you can convince yourself of yourself by looking at the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, for example. That's on sdss.org. And it's fantastic. They have great movies where you can virtually fly through the data that they have measured of where galaxies are sitting. So we start with an idealizing model. We assume that the universe is actually spatially isotropic and homogeneous perfectly, which is of course not true, but it's a good approximation to start with. And that approximation is very valuable because it simplifies, the high symmetry simplifies simplifies all of it, the equations and the solutions. We have only very few degrees of freedom then, and the Einstein equations for those few degrees of freedom can be solved. So concretely, the isotropy and homogeneity means that we are modeling space-time as a manifold, as we've trained to do now for several weeks, as a manifold, it's a differentiable manifold with a metric on it. And we assume that the manifold that describes space-time can be written in this way, namely as the Cartesian product of a time interval, which may or may not be infinite, as a time interval, a part of the real line, cross some space manifold. So this would be time, and that is space. So space is described by a Riemannian manifold, not the pseudo-Riemannian, not the Lorentzian manifold, but just a spatial manifold with a metric that can be diagonalized to take the form 1, 1, 1, and then also a time variable. So that the metric, so we will have two metrics now, one metric just on the spatial part, and one metric for the entire space-time manifold. So on the entire space-time manifold, we assume that there's really only one non-triviality in there. See, if that was absent, we would have just Minkowski space. But we assume now that, we would have something that is not time-dependent anyway. So we assume now that we have minus dt squared plus what is called a scale factor squared, and g bar being the metric of just the spatial manifold, the metric of sigma. The quantities associated with sigma we will generally indicate with some name and a bar over it. So you see we are using here the dt basis vectors, but of course later on we may choose other basis vectors because we will make use of the frame formalism. The frame formalism such that the metric will actually take the form minus 1, 1, 1, 1 in that new basis. When we write the metric of our cosmological space-time in this way, then t will be called the cosmic time. So let us start, before we look at the full space-time, let's just do a little analysis of the options, of the possibilities for the spatial part. The spatial part is a manifold, a Riemannian manifold, which just describes space, which we call sigma, capital sigma. And its metric is a spatial metric, g bar, can be diagonalized to read 1, 1, 1. And by assumption, our universe looks the same everywhere in all directions, isotropic and homogeneous, which means we are assuming that if it has curvature, it's constant. Right? We don't want the curvature to vary from place to place or in direction. But that, of course, restricts the number of possibilities for what that sigma g bar manifold could be tremendously. So what are the possible Riemannian manifolds that have constant curvature? That manifold will have a Riemann curvature tensor. And since it's the Riemann curvature tensor of that space manifold, you know, just taken at one point in time, that Riemann curvature tensor will have a bar over it to indicate it's just the spatial part, the indices running only from 1 to 3. This thing must be expressible in terms of just, I mean, it will have only one free parameter in it. And that's the amount of curvature, which is supposed to be constant. So there's going to be some constant, we will call it k, and that will label the amount of curvature, which is constant. But then that's just one number, because we have only one curvature. But this thing has indices. Somehow these indices must arise. And the only way that they can arise is from the metric tensor. Because the whole thing is symmetric. There is no other tensor there that describes some other non-trivial features. Now, given that we know that the Riemann curvature tensor always has certain symmetries in its indices that arise from Debianchi identities, if you remember. Given that we know that it has a certain index structure, we can make a guess for, or even derive, the expression of the Riemann curvature tensor in terms of the metric. Of course, this only works in very highly symmetric cases. We know that the Riemann curvature tensor, when all the indices are down, has a symmetry when you interchange those two indices with these two indices. It stays unchanged. If you only flip those two indices, you get anti-symmetry. And if you only flip those two indices, you get anti-symmetry as well. If you try to write down an expression in terms of the metric tensor, which has these symmetry properties, a four-index expression with these symmetry properties, you will find that this is the unique way to do it. And of course, even though this combination gives us the right index structure, it's still ambiguous up to a prefactor, and that will be our prefactor K that labels the curvature. So just on the basis of these very stringent symmetry assumptions, we were able to conclude that the Riemann curvature tensor for the spatial part of our spacetime has to take that form. And from that, we can calculate by contracting the indices, contracting two indices, the Ricci tensor, which has only two indices, if you remember, and it is given by 2k g bar. And then when we contract those two indices, we obtain the Ricci scalar, and it comes out to be 6k. The factor of 3 between here and there comes from taking the trace of that. The trace of the spatial-only metric is 3. Now you simply contract the g-bar with the g-bar, right? Okay, so now, we know we can define a triad. We can define a fieldbine. Remember, a fieldbine is another word for a frame field. And depending on how many dimensions the manifold has, you either call it a fieldbine, which applies to all number of dimensions, or a triad if there are three dimensions, and a tetrad if there are four dimensions. So in this case, we have only three dimensions, three spatial dimensions. So we will call the frame that we choose a triad. So that's going to be a basis of the cotangent vector space, three cotangent vector fields that give us a basis of each cotangent vector space at every point. And then once we've made our choice, remember, it's not unique. It's unique only up to rotations. In space-time, it's unique up to Lorentz transformations. Here, it's unique up to rotations. Once we've made our choice, which choice we make doesn't really matter for what we do next. Once we've made our choice, we can then express the curvature 2 form in terms of the Riemann curvature tensor. Remember how that went? The Riemann curvature tensor, plenty of indices, 4 of them. And for example, these two are actually anti-symmetric, and they're lower indices. They're covariant indices, and they are anti-symmetric. We use that fact to declare this part of a differential form. It's a 2 form. And then there were 2 indices left over. So from the Riemann curvature tensor, we obtain the curvature 2 form by declaring 2 of its covariant parts a 2 form. So we contract with the spaces vectors, then we are left with only 2 indices, and now what we obtain is this, which is a 1-1 tensor-valued 2 form, where we have chosen to lower the indices. You can always use the metric to raise it. The metric is, in fact, diagonal. It's just 1-1-1. Now, what's the role of this K? K can be larger than zero, and that's going to be quite different from K equal to zero, and K smaller zero will be yet different. When K is larger than zero, then our space manifold is a three-dimensional sphere. Just like you know of two-dimensional spheres, which are embedded in our three-dimensional space, this three-dimensional sphere can be embedded, for example, in a four-dimensional Euclidean flat space. This would be a closed universe. This would be a universe with a property that if you travel a straight line in one direction, you'll come back eventually to where you started. If you send a light ray in one direction, eventually you'll see it coming back from the other side, independently of which direction you send it off to. Just like on a sphere. No matter which direction you go, you'll come back to where you started. If K is equal to zero, oh, and by the way, such a universe has a finite volume. In this case, the evolution, I mean, I'm anticipating a little bit the dynamics. In this case, the evolution of the universe is such that that volume increases over time. And in particular, at the time of the Big Bang, if it really started in a singularity, the volume would have gone to zero. So you could really think of the universe as starting from a point and then expanding. That's not going to be the case for those. In the case of K equal to zero, sigma, our space manifold, is simply a copy of Euclidean R3. It's completely flat. It's just R3. It has no spatial curvature. It's infinite in volume. And the experimental evidence is that we are pretty close to this. There's no evidence this way or the other way. We seem to be extremely close to that. Apart from the fact that, of course, there are bumps in space-time, wherever matter is, the average seems to be pretty close to flatness. We have no positive indication for any deviation from overall flatness. Then K can also be smaller than zero. In this case, our spatial manifold is a three-dimensional pseudosphere. That would be a constant negative curvature. And that's the kind of curvature that you get, for example, in the saddle of a horse. See, when you're in that saddle, then in two directions, it goes down. But from the front to the back of the horse, it goes up. So it's both like this and like that. And that sort of geometry, that sort of shape, has negative curvature. The angle sum in a triangle will be smaller than 180 degrees. Here it will be larger than 180 degrees. Here it will be exactly 180 degrees. So for K smaller than zero, we would get that kind of manifold, that kind of space. That kind of space is also infinite in size, just like K equals zero. So there too, you can travel forever and never come back. Travel on a straight line forever and never come back. See, it makes a huge difference whether the universe has a finite volume or an infinite volume, and we seem to be just at the borderline there. Which means that if it is finite, it's probably enormous, right? Because it's very, very flat. A sphere whose surface is very, very flat, very close to that of a plane, has to be a huge sphere. So from the experimental evidence that we are very close to this, we can conclude that either the volume in the universe is tremendously large, which would be the case of K being a little bit larger than zero, tremendously large, or it's infinite. So it cannot be a sphere of radius 40, 50 billion light years. It would have to be a way, way larger sphere than that, if it is finite. Now, the Ricci scalar of our space manifold has units. It contains two space derivatives of the metric. Remember, the metric doesn't have units. R is expressed in terms of the metric, and the metric metric second derivatives. Sorry, the Christoffel symbol is also a second derivative. And so the units of the curvature scalar are 1 over length squared. The point being, it has units, which means we can always choose units such that k takes numerically any value we want. It depends on the units that we choose. Cosmologists have taken on the habit of choosing units, therefore, such that k comes out to be plus 1, 0, or minus 1. The dynamics of spacetime is encoded in the scale factor, so we are still free to get all of the dynamics. Just, you can also think of it this way. We choose the unit such that at that time where the a is equal to 1, we have that the k is equal to plus 1, 0, or minus 1. So we could either rescale the scaling factor in the universe once, or we could rescale our units. Either way, we can choose the k to be plus 1, 0, or minus 1, and we choose it with a unit, and then the scale factor is, let's say, 1 today. So we have a triad for the spatial part of the universe. Of the universe's manifold. Now, let's turn that into a tetrad, a basis of the tangent spaces in the full space-time, which now includes space and time. Remember, the metric is by assumption, because of the symmetry, this. So let's define a convenient tetrad, which is to say an orthonormal basis of each of the cotangent spaces and tangent spaces. Should be a star if we deal with the cotangent vectors. and we do it this way. We choose for the basis vector in the time direction simply the dt that comes with the coordinate system. That is a good choice because there's no prefactor here. And after all, our aim in choosing the basis vectors is to diagonalize the metric so that it has coefficients minus 1, 1, 1, 1. So this is consistent with our demands. And then we choose the three other basis vectors that we need for the cotangent space to be scale factor A of t times theta bar I. Because with this definition, defining the A into the frame like that will get rid of the A in here. If we write the metric now in that frame, it will be simply minus theta naught squared plus theta I squared. Sum over the I. Which is to say that the metric will have coefficients minus 1, 1, 1, 1. I should remind you, though, that these guys are orthonormal, a chosen orthonormal by assumption with respect to the metric of just space, the metric g bar. They are not orthonormal with respect to the full spacetime metric, g. These guys are orthonormal with respect to the full spacetime metric, g. Right? So these are orthonormal with respect to those. These are orthonormal with respect to the entire metric. Well, maybe I'll leave that up here. Okay, so now we have our frame. And we can now start to calculate the affine connection. We can define the connection one form. And we can define the torsion, which will come out to be zero. We can define or calculate from that what the Riemann curvature tensor is or what the curvature two form is. So the first step in getting at the more sophisticated quantities, such as the connection one form and the curvature, first step is to use the structure equation. Remember, the structure equations have a fancy name, but really what they are is simply expressing the torsion in terms of the frame and expressing the curvature in terms of the frame. So let's use the first structure. Let's start with the first structure equation. Our aim is going to be to calculate the connection one form, so that we can then plug them into the Einstein equations and solve them and find out what the dynamics is of the night sky. Okay, just to keep overall perspective on what we are doing. Okay, so we use the structure equation. Let's start with the first structure equation. It turns out there are two of them now, because we have two manifolds. We have the manifold sigma of just space, and we have the manifold M of space-time. Each of them has a structure equation. They've got to be compatible, of course, and we make use of that. So what is the first structure equation? For the spatial manifold sigma alone. The first structure equation, if you don't remember, let me remind you, says that the torsion is equal to the total exterior derivative of the frame. And that is equal to zero. Now, we don't have torsion, so this is simply the total exterior derivative of the frame. The capital D applied to the frame gives us that, the exterior derivative plus that piece here. So the first structure equation applied to the space manifold is this. We had exactly that equation earlier in previous lectures. Only now we put a bar on our quantities because this is now applied to just the spatial manifold. Let us call this equation sigma 1. Sigma because it is an equation that arises with the first manifold, just with the space manifold, and 1 because it's the first structure equation. The indices run only from 1 to 3 because we have only space in here. But the first structure, but there's also a first structure equation on the full space-time manifold. Again, it says the full torsion is equal to zero. The full torsion is the total exterior derivative of the frame, of the thetas. And the total exterior derivative of the thetas is this. It's the d theta plus omega wedge theta. It's the same equation as this one, only now this is happening on the full space-time manifold. So we have two first structure equations, and we can make use of that fact. This one we call m1 for being applicable to the entire space-time manifold, and 1 for first structure equation. Our aim is to use those to calculate now the connection one form for the full space-time. By the way, if you're not so sure of how to think of those theta bars, just think of the special case where k is equal to 0. And the spatial part of our space-time manifold, the sigma, is just R3. And then an orthonormal basis will be just, you know, theta 1 is dx1, theta 2 is dx2, and the other one is dx3. That would be a simple special case. Okay, so we want to determine now the connection one form. And the strategy will be this. We calculate the d theta I in two ways, and then make use, basically, you know, the structure equations tell us what happens when we do d theta, and then we get the connection one form involved. Apply d theta, we get the connection one form involved. We take both equations and then hope to somehow calculate what the connection one forms are. Okay, so we calculate what the d theta I is. D theta I is d of scale factor times the theta bar I. Remember, the full space-time frame vectors spatially are just scale factor times the just spatial ones. That was this equation here. The space-time frame is given in terms of the spatial frame vectors just by multiplying with the scale factor. but not so for the theta zero, that was directly the dt. Okay, so we have to take the d of that. We do this, so by the Leibniz rule, we get the dA veg of theta I plus leaving the A alone and applying the D on the theta bar. Again, if K was equal to zero, this would be D of DXI, right? So that would vanish. But in general, it doesn't have to. All right, so now for the next line, we rewrite this piece by writing dA as dA by dt dt, and the A d theta bar I, we can re-express by using the first structure equation sigma 1. Remember? Sigma 1 tells us how we can express d theta in terms of these connection 1 forms for the just spatial part. Right? So the d theta bar I are really just minus omega bar I j veg theta bar j. So this is what we call a dot. The dot indicates time derivative, derivative with respect to cosmic time. The theta naught is by definition just dt. We carry that forward. And we can absorb that A in the theta bar, and it becomes just the theta. Okay, because the theta is the theta j are just the theta bar times the scale factor. Remember. To the next line, we switched around those two. We get a minus sign going from here to there. And also, we get rid of that bar over here by multiplying and dividing with a factor of this, with the scale factor A. And then once we have an A over here, we can write it as a theta I. So we get rid of that bar, but we have to pay with a scale factor A. And that's just carried forward. The point was that we calculated d theta I and found this expression, and we have almost no bars anymore. We made sure that we used the first structure equation to get rid of this bar and that bar. We have quantities here that the frame vectors are all frame vectors of the full space-time. They don't have a bar on them, which is useful because now we're going to use the second structure, the first structure equation for the full spacetime manifold, and there are no bars in that to start with. If we want to compare them with each other, it's good that we have all of this business also without the bars. Okay, so the second structure equation, sorry, the first structure equation for the full spacetime manifold tells us that d theta I is given by that expression. That's just straightforwardly. That was our equation M1. And we can spell out what that is. It's really summing over all values of nu from 0 to 3. Let us separate the case for nu equals 0 from the other cases. So we have this is equal to minus this, where we have this, the term with the 0 here and a 0 there. And then those terms where the j runs from 1 to 3. You noticed, of course, that when I'm using Greek indices, they run from 0 to 3, and then Latin indices run only from 1 to 3. Now we can compare what we obtained in this calculation to this. After all, both express simply d theta I. So we can compare these coefficients, and we find that this theta naught coefficient here comes here with the connection 1 form, but here it comes with this. So that better be the connection 1 form over there. And similarly over here, we have a theta j, whatever is here, got to match that. So we can conclude that the connection one form on our space-time manifold obeys those two equations just by comparing the coefficients. So as far as the spatial part is concerned, the connection one form takes the same coefficients on space as on space-time, but the space and time coefficients of the connection one form take this non-trivial form, a dot over a times theta I. We will later refer to this equation as the equation in the box. Do we have everything now? Let's see. What about the diagonal terms, like especially this one, w of 0, 0? What would that be? Somehow we didn't get hold of that one. But we know already what it is. It's 0. That's because, if you remember the connection one form, when you put the index down, the connection one form is anti-symmetric because the connection one form is infinitesimal Lorentz transformation valued, and infinitesimal Lorentz transformations as matrices are anti-symmetric. So the W00 is vanishing. This is also written here in the black. So now that we have the connection one form, we can calculate the curvature two form. And once we have the curvature two form, we will be able to read off what the curvature tensor is, and we have the Einstein equation. Okay, so what's the curvature two form? That's where the second structure equation comes in. Remember, the first structure equation expresses the torsion in terms of the frame. And since the torsion is vanishing, it just says something about the frame, you know, some equation equal to 0. That's what we just used. But the second structure equation expresses the connection two form in terms of the frame indirectly, because it expresses the curvature two form in terms of the connection one form, and that we just calculated in terms of the frame. So again, we have two structure equations of the second kind, one just for the space part of space-time, and the other one for this full space-time manifold. They look exactly the same, except that the one that's restricted to space will have bars on it. So let's look at the case of spatial indices I and j running from 1 to 3. Then by the second structure equation on the full manifold, by equation capital M2, we have this expression here that's just from here. The only difference between here and here is that I've made a choice that I and j ought to be taken from 1 to 3 and not 0. That's why we went from the Greek to the Latin indices. And then from here to here, we make use of the fact that the connection one form for the space-space component is actually the same on the space-time manifold as it is on just the spatial part. So we can put a bar on here without any change. If you remember, we had that equation earlier. Was it here? In the box, this one. And that one we will also need. So we just put the bar on here, and here we can put a bar as long as the mu is running from 1 to 3. Then we just get this term with the bars. But there's also a term where the mu takes the value 0. That's different. That's this term. And these things together just give us the curvature two form for space only, by definition, by the second structure equation of the spatial manifold. So by the equation sigma 2, these two terms together are just the omega bar ij, and then we still have to carry forward that extra term arrives here. Now from early on in this lecture, remember that we were able to write the curvature two form in very simple terms, because we were able to guess already what the curvature tensor can only look like. Remember, shall we go to the very beginning? We made symmetry assumptions, and then we were able to conclude that the curvature 2 form has to take this form here. Just move that hand out of the way. So on general grounds of just symmetry considerations, we concluded that the curvature 2 form has to take this shape with the K. We can make use of that now. Okay, so we had curvature 2 form takes that shape because of spatial isotropy and homogeneity. Sorry, the curvature 2 form for space, just for space. So just for space, it was that expression. I scrolled back to show you that one. But we'd like to express everything in terms of space-time quantities, so we can remove those bars, but then we have to pay the price and put scale factors in there, because the theta I and the theta I bar are related by a scale factor. So overall, we now obtain that the full space-time curvature 2 form is given by two terms, the first one of which we can write in this way. So we obtain that expression here. And the second term, this one, we can also express in this way because of the left of the two equations in the box, this one, the connection 1 form in terms of the frame fields. Okay, so the omega I naught is a dot over a times theta I. We plug that in here. These two terms give us each an a dot over a times theta I. You see that these are of the same kind. Therefore, the prefactors combine, and we obtain that that the curvature 2 form is given by that, the full curvature 2 form in space-time. A calculation that's very similar to that gives us the zero I component as well. And it's a little tedious, so we won't go through that kind of calculation again. This is the result. At that point, we have everything we need to calculate what the Einstein tensor is, because the Einstein tensor is, we have the connection 2 form expressed as something in front of the wedge product of two basis vectors here and there. And we know how the curvature 2 form is expressed in terms of the Riemann curvature tensor multiplied with or contracted with the wedge product of two basis vectors like that. So we can read off what those coefficients are. And again, it's probably not worth writing them all up because there are plenty of them. See, this runs from 0 to 3, so does that one, so does that one, so does that one. Overall, there are lots of symmetries and anti-symmetries, so that reduces the number of effectively independent components, but it's tedious. So the R mu nu rho epsilon can be read off, then we can contract that, whatever it is, we don't spell it out. We get the R mu nu, and whatever that is, we also don't spell out this one. We can contract further, we get the Riemann curvature, the Ricci scalar. Once we have those two guys, the R mu nu and the R, then we can write down the Einstein tensor. And with the Einstein tensor, we can write down the Einstein equations. Now, the Einstein tensor I will spell out, because that's important, because that will go into the Einstein equation. The Einstein tensor has now only two independent entries. Everything else is zero or the same. So the Einstein tensor has a zero-zero component, which comes out to be this expression. Of course, all of this traces back to our results over here, right? You can get it all from just that, reading off what the Riemann curvature tensor is, contracting indices, and so on. It's a bit tedious, but maybe once in one's lifetime, one should do it. Okay, so the G naught naught comes out to be this. The GII components are always the same. The G11 is the same as G22, same as G33, and it's that expression. And it's a diagonal matrix. All off-diagonal entries come out zero. So we found that in this frame, the Einstein tensor is actually diagonal. Of course, you could always choose a frame in which it is not. How about the energy momentum tensor? Well, given that the Einstein tensor comes out diagonal in this frame, and if this is the energy momentum tensor of an actual space-time that obeys Einstein's equation, then we can conclude that the energy momentum tensor via Einstein's equation also has to be diagonal. So the conclusion is that if space-time is homogeneous and isotropic, these were the assumptions that went into all of this, if space-time is homogeneous and isotropic, then in the frame that we chose, which is just a, you know, technical choice, but in that frame, the Einstein tensor comes out diagonal, and so does the energy momentum tensor. The entries of the energy momentum tensor we will interpret in the usual way, namely the zero-zero component we will call the energy density, and then the II component we will call the pressure. We will also allow for a cosmological constant. A cosmological constant is consistent with our finding. Our finding was that the energy momentum tensor has to be diagonal. And we can always add to the energy momentum tensor a cosmological constant term, because the cosmological constant term is multiplied with the metric, and that is diagonal. When you introduce the cosmological constant term this way, not the Sakharov way, but this way, then the convention is to put 1 over 8 pi g here multiplied with lambda. And you may wonder, why? Why don't I just call this lambda and with a plus sign? Well, you shouldn't, because really where this comes from is the Sakharov way. And then the lambda arises on the other side of the Einstein equation. It arises over there. Right? And the 8 pi g is over here. So by writing the cosmological constant like this, this is how everybody does it in cosmology, by writing in this way, we acknowledge that it really comes from the left-hand side, and we only chose to write the cosmological constant on the right-hand side. Something else also happens when you move it from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, it is called the cosmological constant because Einstein called it like that when he first wrote it down on the left-hand side. When you write it on the right-hand side, you call it dark energy, because now it is part of the energy momentum tensor, right? The energy momentum tensor is energy density and then pressure, and the rest is zero. And then you have this term that originated on the left-hand side. So you can view now the cosmological constant as contributing to the energy density as well as to the pressure. And by the way, how does it contribute to the energy and to the pressure? Does it contribute positively or negatively to the energy? You can read it off. Positively, that's right, because there's a minus sign here, but there's also a minus sign coming from the metric. So overall, there's a lambda up here, a plus lambda over here, well, divided by 8 pi g, and that thing contributes positively to the rho. On the other hand, it contributes negatively to the pressure. So the cosmological constant contributes positively to the energy, negatively to the pressure. So in cosmology, you always have to be a little careful when you speak of dark energy, because often it is implied, but not spelled out, that with the dark energy, there also comes a dark pressure, so to speak. It's not just a contribution to the energy in the energy momentum tensor, but also to the pressure. If the dark energy you're talking about has its origin in the cosmological constant, it comes also with a negative pressure. So what we find here is that the shape of the Einstein equations and the assumptions of symmetry that we made constrain the energy momentum tensor dramatically. We have some entries on the diagonal, which we will call energy density and pressure, and then we have a possibility for a dark energy to contribute to that. But there's very little other fancy stuff that could possibly happen with the matter. The only thing that is non-trivial about the matter, that can still be non-trivial about the matter, is the relationship between the rho and the p. See, if you take a box with gas and you compress it, then its pressure will go up and its energy density will also go up. But what's the relationship between the two? What's the relationship between how the energy density changes as the pressure changes? It depends very much on the gas. For example, there are gases that have energy density but basically no pressure, like dust. Dust would be a gas that has a lot of energy because the dust particles each carry mc squared of energy. But the dust has virtually no pressure. So clearly that's different from other gases. And in any case, who's to say that this energy momentum tensor necessarily arises from a gas? Doesn't have to be. Doesn't have to be a gas or fluid. And basically, for cosmology, gas and fluid are the same thing. So let's ask, what kind of matter can produce such energy momentum tensors? It turns out that the energy momentum tensors that arise in Friedmann-Lemaître spacetimes, the kind that we just discussed, are always of the form of a perfect fluid. But the energy momentum tensor is always of the form of the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid, independently of whether or not the matter is a perfect fluid. It has to be such that it produces the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid. That's because this is the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid. Let's look at that. How come? In which sense is this the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid? Let's prove this. For that purpose, let us introduce a four vector field which is dual to the theta naught. So it's just the time derivative, right? So it's a vector field and it's the time derivative. It's also E naught in our frame. So that vector U, that vector field that we are considering, is a contravariant vector field. It is having coefficients u mu multiplying the basis vectors e mu, and only the u naught is non-zero, it is one, and the other components are zero, just to spell it out completely. Okay, so this is a contravariant vector field. And that contravariant vector field is going to play the role of the velocity vector field for our fluid. And you may wonder, where is it flowing? Which way is this stuff flowing? Okay, this u vector, if it turns out to be really the velocity vector of our fluid, should tell us. So I'm just claiming at the moment that it's going to be the velocity vector. So we use this contravariant vector field u to rewrite our energy momentum tensor. namely our energy momentum tensor from above, this one, using this vector field U, can be written in this form. T mu nu is equal to this plus that. Where the U mu is, you remember, has components 1, 0, 0, 0. And so that will just fix the 0, 0 component of the energy momentum tensor to be what it needs to be combined when combined with the G 0, 0 component over here. So let's look, I mean, this energy momentum tensor is first of all diagonal, okay? Because this is only going to contribute to the 0, 0 component, and that thing is diagonal. On the diagonal, we have the 0, 0 component, and we have the II component. The 0, 0 component is given by a 1 over here, this stuff, and a minus 1 over there, and this stuff. If you add them all up, you just get a you see, this is 1 rho plus p plus lambda bar. Lambda bar is lambda over 8 pi g. And we subtract that, so we get a rho plus, the p goes away, and we get 2 lambda bars, right? Should we get that? I think I missed the factor of 2 over here. But you see how this is going, right? Let's look at the II component. For the II component, this is vanishing. And we just have a 1 over here. So we have a rho minus lambda bar. Did I say p? It's a rho. Yes, it's a rho minus 1 over 8 pi g lambda. So the point is that the energy momentum tensor of an ideal fluid always takes this form where there is some stuff multiplied with the velocity vector, plus some stuff multiplied with the metric. If you remember from earlier lectures, this is by definition the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid. Anything that has an energy momentum tensor of that form, something here, something there, velocity vector squared and g mu nu, is by definition a perfect fluid. So we saw that by definition, any matter that arises in the Friedmann-Lemaître universe is a perfect fluid. Then what's the vector field you doing? Where is it pointing? Where is the flow going? It turns out that the flow is only going in time, not in space, because the u vector has only a zero component, one, and then spatially it's 0, 0, 0. So it has no spatial velocity. There's only velocity in time. It's only moving in time, which is to say it's just the velocity that something has that doesn't move. It's just sitting there. It's just moving in time, but not in space. So this would be us, for example, sitting here in our galaxy and not moving with our galaxy anywhere else. We're just floating. We're just freely floating in space. And we can think of the galaxies as being like dust grains, for example, in the universe. Then those dust grains are not flying about much. In the lowest order approximation, they're just sitting there, and they're only traveling in time. So the fluid would be, for example, today, to a relatively good approximation, the fluid of a dust. And the U vector field is just the geodesic, it's just the velocity vector field that's tangent to a geodesic of freely falling observers like us. We can explicitly verify that U is actually a tangent to a geodesic. So we have to calculate, therefore, that the parallel transport of U in the direction of U is vanishing. Well, U is the vector E naught, it's just d by dt, remember? So we calculate the covariant derivative of E naught in the direction of E naught. This is for that purpose, we have to take the connection one form, feed it the direction vector in which we want to differentiate. Then we get that matrix out, and we have to contract that with the basis vectors. And we will get only a contribution for the zero I component from the left equation in the box up there. We obtain that this is A dot over A of the theta I, and then we feed it the E naught. If we feed the E naught into the theta I, we get a Kronecker delta of I naught, because these are dual bases, and this is running through the space indices only, and that's a zero. This Kronecker delta never gives us a one, the whole thing vanishes, and yes, the U field is simply the tangent to geodesics. So it's a fluid that's simply expanding with the universe. Or shrinking. We haven't really calculated what the universe does yet. But it's always a fluid. I mean, if the matter that produces this perfect fluid-like energy momentum tensor can be thought of as a fluid, when that makes sense, for example, in the case of a gas of light or a gas of galaxies, then the vector U of that perfect fluid is actually the tangent vector to the geodesics of freely flowing particles in that gas. Now, let's solve the Einstein equation. So the Einstein equation looks like that, and it has only two independent equations in it, because the energy momentum tensor and the Einstein tensor are both diagonal. There is a non-trivial zero-zero component to this equation and a non-trivial II component. The zero-zero component of this equation gives us this equation here, just putting together the equations that we had earlier. And that first equation is also called this, the Friedmann equation. And the second equation that comes from the II component is this one. What can we tell about these things? Just by looking at them like that. Is there something we can read off from those equations? We see that K comes in, for example. I mean, there's the scale factor and its dynamics. In the Friedmann equation, only the first time derivative occurs. In the other equation, even the second, along with the first time derivative occurs. The cosmological constant plays a role. It comes in positively on the right-hand side, on the right-hand side of the first equation, because that's the energy-energy component. The zero-zero component of the Einstein equation. Here we have the II component, and here lambda plays the role of a negative pressure. So it comes with a negative sign over here. And see here, the energy density and the cosmological constant contribute to each other. They add. Here the pressure and the cosmological constant are in competition. Well, and we have this K in here. Remember, K plus 1 means that space-time is topologically like a sphere, finite volume. K equals 0 means it's flat, and K equal minus 1 means that space-time is infinite in size, has negative curvature, much like a saddle. One nice thing about this pair of equations is that the term K over A squared occurs in both, which means we can eliminate it. And in this way, we can draw conclusions about the solutions that are independent of K, that will hold true no matter whether space-time turns out to be a finite volume or infinite volume, positive, negative, or zero curvature. So let's do that. So if we take this expression, equation B and equation A with suitable prefactors and so on, then this term k over a squared drops out. So we just add this term, this equation to that equation with suitable prefactors, and we get a combined equation, and that's this equation here in the box. It doesn't have k in it anymore. Now, what can we say about the solutions of that equation now? We have second derivative of the scale factor, and then we have some prefactors, and then we have the first, not the first derivative, just A again. With a minus sign there. So what could be the solutions to this? Imagine if rho and p, if the energy density and the pressure were constant. Let's just assume that for a moment. And let's say lambda was also constant. If they're all constants, then we have a double dot equal to some number times a. What kind of solution would that have? Exponential ones. But it's, of course, a very bad assumption to think that the energy density and the pressure are constant in time. It's not a bad assumption to say that the cosmological constant is constant, because that really has to be a number. That cannot depend on space or time. But the energy density and the pressure surely will depend on time, just because of dilution and compression effects. If the universe is shrinking, then the energy density must increase, the pressure must increase. If the universe is expanding, the energy density must drop, and the pressure must drop. And exactly how they drop will depend on what it is that is, what the matter content is. But definitely they are time dependent. So therefore, we should not expect that this is just an exponential type of solution. Except if perhaps those two terms simply are very small compared to that one. So if, for example, the universe has expanded for a long time, and whatever matter there was in there has been diluted to a great extent, so that the energy density is low and the pressure is low, then maybe the cosmological constant starts to dominate. But if this is very small, and we need to consider only that term, well, then we have the situation that the second derivative is proportional to A, and we can have exponential solutions. We will see much more about this later on. I should also say that what we can also tell from this equation is that independently of whether the universe is closed or open, independently of whether k is positive, zero, or negative, we see that if the universe let's assume the cosmological constant is absent, then the normal situation is that the universe would be decelerating. Just because if this is a positive quantity over here, see, for ordinary matter, the energy density is positive and the pressure is positive. So this has to be a positive number. And the scale factor is positive, 4 pi over 3 is positive. So the whole thing is a positive number times A, always. Even though it might be time dependent, but it's a positive number times A. So what we have is that A double dot is equal to minus positive number times A, which means that the second derivative is negative, which means that the universe must slow down. It must decelerate. If the universe is dominated by ordinary matter, energy density positive, pressure positive, then the universe must decelerate no matter what. The fact that we now see that the universe is apparently expanding, therefore tells us right away that this is not the full story. Probably there is this term as well. And if lambda is big enough, well, then it dominates over that. You see, this is the negative part of the right-hand side. That can be positive. And if that's positive and larger than this, then a double dot can turn positive and the universe will accelerate. This is apparently what the universe has been doing for a few billion years already. Apparently, this is the state of the experimental data. The universe has already diluted to the extent that this term has become small. Well, that whole thing has become small because of little energy density, little pressure in the universe now. So small, in fact, that it's smaller than this piece. To put some numbers to it, it seems that of the right-hand side, this is about twice as big as that at the moment. And so, which is to say that of all the energy that we observe in the universe, about 70%, I will get to those numbers later on again, about 70% is in the form of dark energy. Therefore, this term is dominating that one, and we conclude that because we observe a positive A double dot. And this piece here, which is the matter, the actual matter, consists to a large part, something like 90%, consists of dark matter, whose origin we don't know either. Okay, so this was actually the next slide already. I was anticipating. We know that from supernova distance versus brightness data, and from evidence from the cosmic microwave background radiation, that A double dot is larger than zero now. As I said, lambda seems to dominate nowadays. The energy density seems to be 70% made of the cosmological constant. And only 30% is matter. And of the visible matter, apparently, is only 3% of the energy that's out there. If we now look at the Friedmann equation, I wanted to scroll here. Now look at the Friedmann equation. Here it is. Friedmann equation is nice because it has only the first time derivative in A. If we look at the Friedmann equation in the case where the cosmological constant is dominant, so this piece is neglected, then we find direct evidence that the universe should be expanding exponentially. Let's first look at the case k equal to zero. When k is equal to zero, the universe is completely spatially flat. This term is absent. We also assume that the cosmological constant dominates, so this term is absent. So the Friedmann equation reduces to the equation that A dot over A squared is equal to a constant, which is to say that A dot over A is equal to a constant. But the only function that obeys A dot over A is equal to a constant is the exponential function. So we see here that indeed cosmological constant dominance means exponential expansion or exponential shrinkage. See, here we couldn't really tell because it was the second derivative. This was an equation that we arrived at by combining the two equations, two Einstein equations. Couldn't really tell because it was the second derivative. So we thought maybe, you know, sine, cosine might be able to do it or something. But no, it don't. The Friedmann equation tells us that it has to be an exponential solution. Now, what if k is not zero but is positive or negative? Well, in that case, you can still solve the equation. It's just a bit more messy. And instead of the exponential behavior of the scale factor, we now obtain hyperbolic cosine behavior or hyperbolic sine behavior. So the scale factor now goes like the hyperbolic cosine or the hyperbolic sine as a function of time, depending on whether the space-time is spatially a sphere or it has negative curvature. But hyperbolic cosine and hyperbolic sine are both also exponential eventually, asymptotically. So asymptotically, it's always exponential behavior. So far, we only looked at the asymptotic behavior. We only looked at the case where it's extreme. Like only the cosmological constant dominates and we get exponential behavior. And we said that if, on the other hand, the cosmological constant is negligible, and instead we have only ordinary matter, so we have only rho and, we just be precise, if this is absent and we have only that, then we concluded that because all of these coefficients are positive, A double dot has to be negative. So we drew two very general conclusions. One is that if matter dominates, the universe has to decelerate. Because that's a minus, and then the rest is positive. And we also concluded that if on the in the other extreme this dominates, then we must have exponential expansion. But what about the actual details? How does it actually come out? And we actually want to calculate what the dynamics really is. Then we need a strategy for solving all those equations. And that, of course, has to do with your project for the course as well. So let's take stock of what we have. We have three unknown functions to solve for. The first is the scale factor. The second is the energy density as a function of time. And the third is the pressure as a function of time. But we luckily also have three equations for those three functions to be determined. Namely, we have our two Einstein equations, the 0-0 component and the II component. You know, the stuff in the box over there, this one, the Friedmann equation, which is the 0-0 component, and then the II component equation. We have those two equations for rho, p, and a. Right? Rho, p, the pressure, and a, the scale factor, but only two equations. We need a third one, and we have a third one because depending on what the matter is that fills the universe, there will be some relationship between the pressure of that matter and the energy density of that matter. If you know that it's a hydrogen gas, you can calculate what the relationship is for hydrogen gas between pressure and energy density. If you know that it's just dust, again, easy, the pressure is going to be zero. It may have some energy density, but the pressure is going to be zero. Here are the main cases. One case was that vacuum energy is what fills the universe, predominantly. Other stuff, let's say, doesn't matter. In that case, we know that the pressure, as a function of the energy density, is simply minus the energy density. Okay? Remember that? That's because the cosmological constant multiplies the metric in the energy momentum tensor, so it contributes equally to the energy density as it contributes to the metric, just with opposite, as it contributes to the pressure, just with opposite signs. So the pressure is always the negative of the energy density. So we have this function p of rho, which is minus rho. Sorry about those indices, we don't need them. And there's evidence that today the situation might be similar to this. And also in the very, very early universe, there was probably a period in which this was the case, where the universe was dominated by something that behaved like pure vacuum energy. Then what if the universe is filled with light? The very early universe was filled with light. Electromagnetic radiation, it was very, very hot and dominant. It was dominated over other forms of energy and dominated over the cosmological constant. One can calculate from electrodynamics that in the case of a photon gas, the pressure is always a third of the energy density. Of course, always in the natural unit. Okay, so that just comes out from general electrodynamics. And in the case of a dust, well, dust is a kind of gas that doesn't have pressure. So it will have energy density because the stuff that's in it, the dust particles, will have, if anything, at least they will have mc squared for all of the masses in there. So there will be energy density, but not necessarily any pressure. So for pure dust, the pressure is equal to zero. In general, as the universe evolves, the relationship between pressure and energy density evolves too. Because the universe is sometimes dominated by this kind of stuff, sometimes by that kind of stuff, sometimes it's mostly radiation, another time is mostly a dust of galaxies, another time they have been diluted so much that the universe is dominated by dark energy. Which means that that this relationship between pressure and energy density changes. It evolves over time. So we have three equations for three unknowns, right? So we have to determine the function a of t, rho of t, p of t. And the equations that we have available are the two Einstein equations and the relationship between p and rho. If we make an assumption about that relationship, for example, that it's this case or that case or that case, then we have the third equation. In a period of time in the universe when it was radiation dominated, this would be the relationship between p and rho. That's our third equation, and we can solve for the three solutions there. How do we actually go about solving now the three equations for the three unknown functions? It starts with the observation that the Friedmann equation, which is the first of the two Einstein equations, only contains A and rho, but not the pressure. It's clear it can't contain the pressure because the Friedmann equation is the first of the Einstein equations. It knows only about the zero-zero component of the Einstein, of the energy momentum tensor. Okay, so the idea then is to try to express the energy density as a function of the scale factor. See, the Friedmann equation only contains those two. If we are able to express the energy density as a function of A, well, then we are winning, because then the Friedmann equation becomes an equation of A only. One equation, one unknown. We have only one ordinary differential equation to solve. Okay, so if we manage to express the energy density as a function of the scale factor, which is to say, if we can calculate how the energy density changes as the universe expands, as a gas expands, without having the p as an extra variable in it, if we can eliminate that variable, then we can plug rho as a function of A in the Friedmann equation, and we get an equation only in A. And indeed, it is possible to find an equation that relates rho and A to each other. Here's that equation. It's a very important equation, and it looks a little bit complicated perhaps at first sight, but as I will show you, it's actually completely natural and has a simple physical interpretation. But the point technically for us is that it establishes a relationship between rho and A. And so together with the Friedmann equation, which also establishes a relationship between rho and A, we can solve for both rho and A. So this equation doesn't directly give us rho as a function of A. But let's say you know that we are considering a particular epoch in the age of the universe, in the history of the universe, a particular epoch where the universe was dominated by a particular kind of matter. Let's say radiation or something. So we had a particular relationship between pressure and energy density in that epoch. We write this down as an equation of state, as so-called equation of state, which is simply expressing the pressure in terms of the energy density. So let's say the universe is in an epoch where this relationship is known. The pressure is proportional to the energy density, and that prefactor W is assumed to be known. Of course, in the longer term, it's changing in time. But let's just look at an epoch where that proportionality factor between energy density and pressure was pretty much constant. Then, if we can make that assumption, then that equation over here will give us the energy density as a function of the scale factor, simply because then this occurrence of P can be expressed in terms of rho, and then we have only an equation in rho and A, which we can solve, and then we have rho of A, put it in the Freeman equation, and solve for A. So, for example, from what we discussed earlier, in the case of a dust-dominated universe, the pressure is equal to zero, and when the pressure is equal to zero, so if W is equal to zero, the pressure is equal to zero, the right-hand side is equal to zero, but what does the scaling behavior of rho have to be so that that derivative is equal to zero? Any guesses? You see, this equation tells us that when there's no pressure, when we're dealing with dust, when there's no pressure, this has to be zero. So this whole thing should not be A dependent. So rho has to be A to the power minus 3, right? If rho is proportional to A to the power minus 3, then this does not depend on A. The time, the derivative with respect to A is vanishing. So for P equal to zero, for the case of a dust-dominated universe, this equation tells us that the energy density has to scale with the power of A to the, with a proportional A to the power minus 3, which is, if you think about it, totally plausible. It simply means stuff gets diluted. You have so much energy density, and now the universe expands with a scale factor of whatever, let's say it doubles in size. I mean, doubles, every distance doubles, then the volumes go eightfold, the energy has to go down by a factor of eight. Okay, so if you take something in a box and you make the box larger, the density of whatever is in there, including energy, will have to go down with a third power, because volume scales with a third power. That's what we just derived here. Now, if you do the same kind of calculation for the case of a radiation-dominated universe, where the pressure is a third of the energy density, remember that came from here, pressure is a third of the energy density. If you do that, then we find, surprisingly, that the energy density scales with A to the power of minus 4. It's a little odd. So let's say you have a box of stuff, and you make the box bigger. Then we said that the energy density ought to scale with the third power. But if the box is filled not with regular stuff, but with radiation, then the energy density drops with the fourth power. How come? Yes, that's right. Because the wavelengths also get stretched out. So in addition to the photons being diluted, their wavelengths also get stretched out. And that gives us an extra factor of the scale factor. So radiation dilutes faster than the energy in radiation dilutes faster than the energy in regular matter. Then if we look at a cosmological constant dominated epoch of the universe, then we have that the pressure is equal to minus the energy density. If we plug that into our equation over here, then we can conclude that rho is equal to a constant. Right? Because if rho is a constant, then we have that the derivative of A to the third power is A to the second power. That's what we have over here. Which is to say that dark energy doesn't dilute at all. The cosmological constant doesn't dilute because it is a constant. It just doesn't depend on space or time. Okay, either way.
It's kind of disturbing from an energy conservation point of view. And I know GR plays fast and loose bits.
Yes, it does.
Ridiculous.
Yes, but that's how it comes out. That's right. Okay, but remember what the purpose of it was. We used that equation to express the energy density as a function of the scale factor. The reason we wanted to do that is that we can then eliminate the energy density in the Friedmann equation. The Friedmann equation contains two variables, rho and A. Now we can express rho in terms of A. So the Friedmann equation becomes an equation only in A. So we'll do that in a moment. Let me just finish with, we'll do that in the next lecture. We will actually solve then the Friedmann equation and solve for the evolution of Friedmann-Lemaître space-times for the different kinds of epochs. But let us have just a quick look again at what this equation really means. Remember that there was some intuition for what it meant in particular cases. We found that in the case of dust, where there is no pressure, that the energy density, according to this equation, will dilute inverse proportionally to the volume, as one might expect. In the case of radiation, where the pressure is a third of the energy density, this equation told us that the energy density is now diluting like the fourth power. That's because of the fact that in addition to the dilution of the number of photons, we also get a stretching of the wavelength. That gives us an extra scale factor. And also the last solution made sense, the last solution of that equation for the cosmological constant case, where it told us that the energy density stays constant if the energy density is due to a cosmological constant, because that's supposed to be a constant. What does it really mean in general? Where does this equation come from? Well, the intuitive meaning of that equation is the following. It is the general relativistic version of the continuity equation, of the equation that says that whatever goes somewhere in has to come out somehow. You know from ordinary thermodynamics that if you take a box of gas and you ask how does the energy change if I change the volume, well, the change in energy is proportional to the change in volume, and the proportionality constant is exactly the pressure, okay? Because you're doing work against the pressure, you get a change in energy. This is in the case of adiabatic expansion. Adiabatic means you're doing work against the pressure, but you're not actually actively heating or cooling the box. There's no heat flow between the inside and the outside of the box. It's only heating up because you're pressing on it. The box is not heating up because you are putting an iron on it or something. Okay, so let's take that naive equation here and apply it in GR. So what is the volume? Volume scales with A to the third power. The energy is energy density times volume. So therefore, that equation here is dE is d volume times energy density, that's the energy, equal to minus pressure, and then dV is d A to the third power. We can write out what that is. This is P times 3 times A squared dA. Divide by dA, and you get that dA to the third power rho over A is equal to that, which is the equation above. Okay? So that's this equation above. But you realize that that was not legal to make assumptions like this. So it has to be properly derived from within general relativity, and there it follows from this equation. This one. And I've put it here in two slides for you. But again, it's quite straightforward. Please check it yourself. And if you get stuck somewhere, let me know, and I'll get you unstuck. And that's it for today.